This HedgeGhoul series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com.
Well, good afternoon, history lovers, and welcome to the second History Ireland HedgeGhoul of the Electric Picnic with Tommy Graham, editor of History Ireland, in the chair. So having had a look at the death of Michael Collins, the murder of Michael Collins, and we may come back to that later. What we're going to discuss here this afternoon is, what if Michael Collins had survived the Civil War? Now, born in West Cork in 1890, Michael Collins joined the IRB as a teenager while working as a clerk in London. He fought in the GPO in 1916 and rose to prominence by the War of Independence, combining the positions of Dáil Minister for Finance, Head Centre of the IRB, and IRA Director of Intelligence and of Organisation. In the latter roles, he pursued a ruthless but effective policy of assassination of British agents and informers. One of the signatories of the Anglo-Irish Treaty of December 1921, in January 1922, he was elected chairman of the Provisional Government. Following the outbreak of the Civil War in July 1922, he resigned that position to become Commander-in-Chief of the pro-treaty National Army. He was killed in an ambush at Béal na Bláth, County Cork, on the 22nd of August 1922. But what if he hadn't been killed? To discuss the what-ifs, I'm joined by Paddy Cullivan. Let's hear it again for that tour de force. We're going to allow Paddy a few minutes to catch his wind before we bring him into this discussion. Somebody got the oxygen handy there. He looks like he needs it. On my left here, Brian Hanley, a regular attender at the Electric Picnic, Assistant Professor of 20th Century Irish History in Trinity College Dublin. And just immediately to his left, David McCullough, journalist, broadcaster and biographer of Eamon de Valera. On my right, Fergal McGarry, Professor of Modern History at Queen's University, Belfast, and a biographer of Owen O'Duffy. And finally, Miriam Smarter's sister, Margaret O'Callaghan, who's lectures in history at Queen's University, Belfast. Now, just to make it, and by the way, you are at school here, guys. It's a History Ireland Head School. You're expected to pay attention, sit up straight in your seat, and participate in the discussion, right? So, you know, formulate those questions as we go. And we don't just tack on a few questions at the end. You can intervene in this discussion at any time. And we have a mic here, especially for the audience. And make sure you use the mic, because this is all being recorded. So keep it clean. And it will be released on podcast in due course on the History Ireland website, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Okay, now, just to start, I have a list of contrafactuals, as we call them here. On my first one, I'll go to you, Brian Hanley, but the rest of you can all come in on this, is what if Michael Collins had become a military dictator? And I'm going to qualify that by saying, was he a military dictator in any case before he met his death at Béal na Bláth? Brian.
Yeah, I mean, Collins had already acquired dictatorial powers by essentially creating a military council of himself, Owen O'Duffy, and Richard Mulcahy, and making decisions without any recourse to either his own cabinet or the elected parliament as it was. And in fact, that parliament didn't meet until after his death. But I'm going to abuse my position here, because firstly, I can't talk at an event like this without saying that Michael Collins was not murdered. He was killed in a gun battle. If you're a soldier, an armed soldier, engaged in combat with your enemies, and you die in a gun battle with them, you are not murdered. He was killed by the anti-treaty IRA, who were pretty clear at the time that they killed him. The only worry from Liam Lynch was that they hadn't done better and killed more of the people who were with him. This is a century-old conspiracy theory, which doesn't add to our knowledge of the revolutionary period and doesn't add to how we judge these events today. Michael Collins was fighting a war. He was determined to crush the anti-treaty IRA, which is why he had acquired dictatorial powers. It was actually some of the civilians in the cabinet who were holding him back. He was also very worried about the fact that the Labour Party, which had done very well in that election, which had won, you know, over 20% of the vote, would again attempt to stop the Free State carrying out the war in the way that he wanted. And he didn't want them to essentially do that. He said to O'Duffy, once we've dealt with the anti-treatyites, we will then have to deal with Labour. He was clear to Liam Lynch and others that there was no peace deal. He said to them, you've had your chance. You had your chance when you didn't do anything about the Four Courts. It's a war now, and I want those weapons handed over. He cynically used the Northern IRA to do his bidding because Colin supplied guns to the Northern IRA. And where did you get the Northern IRA in 1922? You get them in Free State uniform. So that was a way of getting rid of a potential threat. The fact is, he had acquired dictatorial powers. We don't know what would have happened. He may have handed power back to the cabinet. That didn't happen because he was killed. The only reason that the Dáil was eventually able to meet was because Collins was killed, which in some ways then contributes ultimately to a more democratic outcome.
Yeah, just to clarify something, there was an election held in June 1922, just before the outbreak of the Civil War, which returned a pro-treaty majority of about 2-1. But that Dáil didn't meet until September. You know, just you had the facts here, right? So the argument that the Civil War had some sort of a democratic mandate is open to question, in the sense that the mandate had been given, that the Dáil that had the mandate wasn't allowed to meet until the following September. But I'll let you in later, Paddy, on this, right? But Fergal, on the question, would Collins have become a dictator, or was he one anyway before he was killed?
Well, I'm personally not that sort of swayed by the dictator kind of idea. I mean, in a time of war, you don't expect democracy to function in a normal kind of way. There was an election. The pro-treatyites won a large majority. There was a parliament. It's true that the sitting of that parliament had been suspended several times. It's difficult to predict the future, but I don't see much evidence that Collins would have... I don't see much evidence that Collins would have held on to power, or indeed that there would have been a consensus around that. I mean, one of the things I'm struck by about a lot of this revolutionary generation, including revolutionaries and Fenians, IRB members, is the extent to which they had sort of internalized democratic values. Even on the anti-treaty side, although they reject the treaty, you don't get that much kind of you don't get that much idea that there should be a complete rejection of democracy as a political system. So my sense is that, if you look at the treatyite cabinet, there's a lot of different sort of political factions within that. They're not necessarily all particularly sympathetic to Collins, but you don't get that kind of idea of a sort of a suspicion or a fear of Collins having seized power and relinquishing it. It seems to have been seen as a practical necessity. It was a civil war. There was a chance that the whole state might collapse if they didn't get to grips with the military situation. And I think Collins's power at that time reflected that. If Collins hadn't died, I could see actually a case that you might have had even a strengthening of democracy, because I think he would have provided the pro-treatyites with a politically more effective leader, and his interpretation of the treaty, you know, the idea of a stepping stone of working towards achieving a republic in terms of its relationship with Britain and also a more aggressive northern policy, I think that actually probably would have made Cumann na n-Éill a much more effective political force. And you can imagine how they might even have been more successful and not lost power in 32 if we're going into counterfactuals.
Yeah, maybe David, I'd throw the same question to you. Like, what's the view that Collins was a dictator before he died? I mean, do you go along with that?
I think Ryan put his finger on it. We don't know what would have happened, because he had assumed these powers. The middle of a war, it's not unusual for a head of government or a leader of government to assume powers like that while the war is being prosecuted. Would he have handed power back? Would he have relinquished that control? We simply don't know. But I think I'd agree with Fergal. I think there is, if you look at his speeches, if you read what he was saying, if you hear what he was actually talking about at the time, there was this talk about democracy, and I think it would have been likely, but we can't be sure, that he would have handed power back, principally because he would have been reasonably confident, I think, that he would have won any electoral contest in the foreseeable future after 1923.
You pose a question there, you know, would Collins have handed back power, right? I mean, I would point out, just as a matter of fact, that Collins was a guy who tended to accumulate positions.
Yeah.
And for example, he was Minister of Finance during the War of Independence. He never resigned that position. He was still Minister of Finance when he was killed, you know.
Because you wouldn't trust some other fellow to do the job as well as he could.
Yeah, but I'm just making the point that, you know, even without even speculating, he seemed to be a person who accumulated power. Now, it's a matter of opinion whether you think he used it positively
or
negatively.
You can look at Europe around that time, and you can see lots of places where military strongmen gained power because of, you know, civil unrest or civil war or whatever, and kept it. You know, Pilsudski in Poland and Horthy in Hungary and so on, Primo de Rivera in Spain around the same time. So there was a trend, and it would have been within that trend, I suppose, if Collins had gone that way. On the other hand, though, in Ireland, thanks to the Irish Parliamentary Party, thanks to the O'Connellite legacy, there is a legacy of public participation, of democracy, that might have been stronger than it would have been in other countries.
Margaret, can I go to you? I want to go away from the what ifs here, right? And just
give this question, Margaret, for a bit. We're acting as if he is a creature who can make circumstances to his own liking. I think we've got to understand the forces operating upon him all through 1922. So he does end up with these what look like potentially quasi-dictatorial powers. But we've got to remember that he's getting telegrams on a weekly, fortnightly basis from Churchill. He is being dictated to by London to a very high degree. You know, he's trying to... His involvement in the North is not entirely cynical. He is worried about the position of nationalists in Belfast. The killing figures for Belfast in that first half of 1922 are huge. He does involve himself in that. I don't think we fully yet know on to the two sides of the IRA precisely what they were doing in the first half of 1922. But we do know that Craig is worried by, say, April of 22, that London isn't supporting. So London have put tens of thousands of pounds, huge support for the Beast specials, massive security apparatus into Northern Ireland. But what's happening in Westminster is liberal voices are saying, are we really funding this? Looks like a sectarian state. Now, what happens between May and June of 1922 is really crucial, because you get Baleek and Pettigo in, you know, a so-called invasion by the south of the north, a strengthening of the Northern administration. And Churchill, you know, it's almost like the Palestinians and the West Bank. I mean, the message from London is either you enforce this treaty, you put your house in order, we'll give you the guns, you move on the forecourts. If you don't do that, though, we are going to go in and take the place over again. So he's gone to very considerable lengths through the packed elections and a variety of other moves to attempt to avoid civil war. But at the end of the day, London calls the shots. Churchill said, and it's Churchill more than Lloyd George, says, if you don't move on the forecourts, we will. So he's very much oppressed by a set of circumstances over which he's very limited control.
Okay, Paddy, I want to go to you, right? Because one of the, I mean, you're dealing with the killing of Michael Collins, whatever, murder, assassination, whatever word you want to use.
I only named it that to annoy Brian. I only did that to annoy you, sorry.
But one of the what-ifs that you posit is, and you give as evidence his interaction with the anti-treaty IRA, which Margaret has just mentioned, and that's on the record, right? But what we don't know is exactly what he was up to. That's not on the record, and we've had this discussion several times, and Margaret's been involved in them. But basically, your thesis seems to be then that if he hadn't been killed, that he was all set to tear up the treaty and invade the North.
Well, he said it in the famous book by Ernie O'Malley, The Men Will Talk to Me. He talks to two IRA men and says, these are just regular privates. And he says, we're going to get in arms and then tell the Brits to go to blazes in 6 months.
It could be January.
Everything changes. Like, correct.
It matters when he says it.
It matters when he says it. But Margaret, the funny thing is, on July 26th, then he says to W.T. Cosgrave, we now have a force with his big army. You see, remember, the National Army is only 4,000. But once the Civil War starts, Churchill says you can make an army as big as you like. So by July, he's got 20,000 to 35,000 men building towards the 58,000 that we eventually have. And he says to Cosgrave on the 26th of July, that late, we now have a force that means something in our future dealings with Britain and the Northeast. Remember, you're right about the pressure, Collins.
That doesn't mean an invasion, though, Paddy.
Well, you're right.
It means that the Brits have to take the Dublin government seriously.
Well, this is true, but remember that Wilson is saying for the whole first 6 months, I have 50,000 men, you have 4,000. I could just take you in the morning. Remember that during the entire War of Independence, it was only 42,000 Irish or British troops in Ireland. Henry Wilson has 50,000 B-specials and British Army. Collins has 4,000. He's always thinking numbers, being the economics guy. And he's just going, you're right, maybe it's not to invade. But then again, he talks about invasion all the time. So it's, who knows? I'm not... And the reason I think he's murdered, Brian, is because, you know, just let me answer that one thing. That document you talk about, the report by Liam Deasy to Liam Lynch, it never states ever we killed Michael Collins. It just says we have learnt of the death of Michael Collins. That's all it says. And even in 1964, when the ambushers met up with each other in the Metropole Hotel, they said, we didn't see anything, we don't know what happened, and everything else is just circumstantial. So the reason I call it a murder is A, to annoy people, and it has annoyed everybody. But to me, the cover-up denotes something wrong, and that's why I did that. So that's all.
Yeah, just want to jump in and reiterate, I think, the importance of Margaret's commentary about the political context that Collins is responding to in a revolutionary scenario where it's not clear that the treaty settlement is even going to hold for the first 6 months of 22. I mean, people quote Collins to suggest different things, but that's deeply problematic because Collins is clearly saying different things to different people. Yeah. And this isn't hypocritical or inconsistent. This is actually necessary for the state to survive. It's under so many different threats. Collins has to sort of placate Northern nationalists, Northern Republicans who are basically enduring a pogrom. So he has to tell them, don't worry, we're going to come to your aid. Collins, the Free State itself, is under threat from the anti-treaty Republicans, so he has to say to anti-treaty Republicans, don't worry, I'm not actually going to enforce this treaty. And then he has to say multiple things to pro-treatyites, to pro-treaty politicians. He has to say, of course we're going to accept the treaty. And to pro-treaty militarists, people like Ona Duffy, revolutionaries who support Collins, he has to say, of course we're going to rip up the treaty. So it's really entirely problematic to sort of take different aspects of what Collins says to construct an argument. But I do think the crucial thing is when push comes to shove, he signed the treaty. You know, he got behind the political settlement, and as a good kind of revolutionary, dealing to a very precarious situation, he tried to keep all his options open, responding, essentially just trying to hold things together to stop this kind of collapse. And by the summer of 22, when you get the assassination of Henry Wilson, and push comes to shove, and the British government say, OK, it's decision time. Either you really enforce the treaty and move against anti-treaty Republicans, or we intervene militarily. I don't think there's any question but that Collins was always going to do what he did. He was going to back the treaty. He kicked the ball down the line as much as he could, which is what any effective politician did. But ultimately, you have to make a decision, and when the pressure becomes too much.
Can I just on the question? I just before we finish up on the possibility of an order invasion, right? The point is, we do have an idea what it would have been like. Precisely the leaked Pettigo incident that Margaret referred to, where it was a little piece of Fermanagh that couldn't be reached overland from the north. So it was kind of low-hanging fruit, which was invaded by a combined pro- and anti-treaty IRA force just before the Civil War. But we know what happened. The British moved in artillery, only the first time it had been used since 1916. Yeah. And they were out like in jig time. So, you know, and Margaret's already referred to the fact that there were about 40, 50,000 heavily armed specials, you know, so yeah. An invasion of the north wouldn't look so pretty. Brian, you want to come in on that?
Well, yes. Firstly, it's fantasy to think that Collins could have marched on Belfast. Marching on Cork against the anti-treaty IRA is much easier than marching on Belfast. So let's get the fantasy war games out of our head. That would have been disastrous, mostly disastrous for Catholics in Belfast, who would have had 10 times worse backlash. But secondly, Collins is a conspirator, and conspiracy means lies. He's in the IRB. Sorry, folks, IRA leaders tell volunteers lies all the time. And in 1921, Collins tells the IRA what they want to hear. Ona Duffy tells the IRA in Monaghan, this treaty's only a joke. We just want to get guns off the Brits and then we'll blow the treaty to hell. They tell people that because they want to bring people with them. The IRA always does that. So Collins is deeply cynical. He's also, of course, capable of the most corrosive kind of rhetoric. So, of course, Countess Markovic, who we all know today as a great hero of the revolution, what does he say about her in the treaty debates? I'm just an ordinary boy from Cork. I don't come from the class that this lady comes from. Again, you know, this is, I think, what we call dog whistle politics. Now, when De Valera and Childers and so on walk out at the end of the treaty debates, Collins stands up and says, traitors, deserters, Englishmen, Americans, foreigners all. Again, you know, a pretty strong dog whistle because it's used during the Civil War to demonise Erskine Childers, for example, whose nationality wasn't a problem until then. So I think the fact is that Collins is a politician. He plays the I'm only a simple lad from Cork trick when he's a consummate networker and he's a consummate power grabber. And I don't think there's any way he's given up that power. And again, I think, in like, nobody who's been in a gun battle can give you a realistic account of what happened. You know, there are things that just happen because of complete disasters and mess-ups. Collins was not in Cork to make peace. He was there because he had decided that the war was ultimately being won very quickly. And that's the reason why he didn't have to resort to the repression that comes later. Actually, the death of Collins does give a boost to the anti-treaty IRA. It completely shakes the administration, and they're on the back foot for several months, which is one of the reasons why the civil war goes on as long as it does. Collins thought the civil war would be over very quickly. His death makes it longer. But again, I've gone off place here. But this isn't the wide broth of a boy from Cork just making his way in the world with the love of the Irish people ultimately in his heart. This man liked power and got to power, and you don't do that if you can't tell lies.
Yeah, actually, Brian, you've raised the next point I want to go on to, which you've touched on, and again, it's referred to in Paddy's presentation earlier, in terms of the extrajudicial, you know, executions that took place, 81 or whatever it is, on the anti-treaty side, Collins doesn't have any of that blood on his hands because he's dead. So the question I want to throw out then is, would Collins have been more or less ruthless in pursuing the civil war, in pursuing those policies?
Collins would have done what he felt was necessary to win. And if that meant executions, he would have been in favour of executions. I mean, this is the man who orchestrated Bloody Sunday. And, you know, that the level of people say, oh, well, he wouldn't have ordered the murders of the four in Mountjoy prison because they were friends of his. Kevin O'Higgins was a friend of theirs. He signed the death warrant. Mulcahy was friends of theirs. He went through with it. If it was necessary, if Collins thought it was necessary, I have no doubt that he would have done it.
Right.
I disagree completely.
Paddy?
I don't think he would have. I think you look at his movements, talking to Tom Malone on the way down to Maryborough, you see him trying to constantly talk to people. And I know you're saying he's not down to make peace, Brian, but I'm sorry. There were feelers put out. Dalton himself admitted, and then didn't admit, because he always contradicts himself, that he was putting feelers out. Flory O'Donoghue is a...
But what was Collins offering?
Well, the offering was unconditional surrender. I get that. We get that.
But which wouldn't have been acceptable to the IRA under any circumstances.
Well, we don't know that because the feelers are being put out.
We do, because they rejected it time and time again.
They did reject it, except for the point that he's down there to meet people, and he is meeting people, and he's going to meet people, whoever he can, and try and make peace. Collins, the whole thing about the Civil War, which I don't go into the show because it's too complicated, is the IRA had split. So Liam Lynch is in the Clarence Hotel, and a kind of a hardcore bunch are in the forecourts. And Collins, when he takes out the forecourts, thinks he's taking out a rump of the IRA. He thinks it's going to be over in seconds and it'll be fine. It's his big mistake. It's a big mistake of his life. But then again, if he doesn't do it, the Brits are going to invade from the Phoenix Park. So the whole thing is a series of bad events that lead to this. And I think Collins is trying to damage limitation all the time. He's always trying to... Can we get this over with, please? Right? So I can get back to the real work I have. And this is the issue. And I know we can all put... This is what this show is about what he was thinking, or what, you know, we can't know what he was thinking. But I certainly know that if he's talking to W.G. Cosgrave and saying, we're going to invade the North, was he a military dictator? He was president of the IRB. The IRB itself is a dictatorial organization, as Brian has said, that these, you know, the reason Collins goes to the treaty is not because Dev asked him to and he said, oh, Jesus, I will. It's because he's president of the IRB. The IRB sees itself as superior to all organizations, including Sinn Féin, the IRA and everybody else. He's the president of Ireland, according to the constitution of the IRB, if there was one. I don't know if there was.
Fergal, jump in there quick.
Yeah, I just want to make a very quick point, which is, you know, I think we need to stop looking at Collins as if he's some omnipotent personality. He's part of wider structures, IRB, the Irish Volunteers. And so he's the group that he's most representative of is this sort of the revolutionary Republican gunmen who went pro-treaty. And so when you look at the pro-treaty cabinet, you can see actually that there is a division. And that division is between the pro-treaty civilian politicians and the pro-treaty Republican revolutionaries who are coming from that IRB, Irish Volunteer background. And if you look at after Collins dies, there are moments of tension, but they're not over executions. There's a consensus within the cabinet from the gunmen and from the civilian politicians that the executions are necessary. So I think Collins would have gone along with that. The tension is actually over peace initiatives. The civilians get really annoyed with people like Richard Mulcahy for sort of holding out the hand of peace. But I do think they're not, you know, there's not some kind of master plan as if they're going to sort of subvert democracy. They were just much more interested in stopping the violence with the comrades that they had fought with. And I think that's where you would have seen some tensions, but not to the extent
of
Collins overruling the pro-treaty cabinet consensus about the need for a clear victory in the Civil War.
But can we agree on this? That Michael Collins would never have shot his childhood friend Dick Barrett. Michael Collins would never have executed Erskine Childers.
No,
he would never have done it. He would never It's inhuman to think that Michael Collins would kill his childhood friend Dick Barrett.
Just hold on there for 1 second, guys. No, I tell you what, my position's become redundant here in the chair. And I'm just getting a warning out to all you people in the audience. If you want to ask questions, you want to get them in quick, right? But this crowd get talking, you won't get a word in edgeways. And if you just come in, this is the History Ireland Head School. We are looking at the what if Michael Collins had survived? It looks like there would have been a big row, actually, if he had survived.
Yes, there will.
No, listen, Mark, just one thing I just wanted, before we move on from the Northern thing, right? Not the Northern thing, but the British government's position, because it's already been stated that they were threatening to take out the guys in the forecourts. Was that a bluff? Because the last thing they wanted was to restart the war in Ireland. What do you think?
I don't think it really was a bluff, but I think it was they would have done something, because after Beleek and Pettigo, a border commission, now not the boundary commission, a border commission is set up. I think they would have done something, but it also enabled them to get off the hook of the North in a way, because once you were looking at what was happening in the forecourts, all the questions that had been there about Craig's administration and what Craig was doing, it gave Craig a breathing space. The theatre altered. We act like the Civil War only happened in the South, but something very serious had been going on in the North for the previous 6 months. So it successfully partitioned a complex situation.
Right. Yeah, Brian, yeah.
Sorry, just briefly. We can't know what Collins would have done, obviously, but we do know what his closest comrades did. And if you were going to believe that people like Paddy O'Daly and Joe Dolan and Charlie Dalton and all these other guys who were intensely loyal to Collins and who committed the worst atrocities of the Civil War after his death wouldn't have behaved like that if Collins was around, then it says, ask questions about what they believed in, because did they only believe in what Michael Collins believed, which raises all kinds of other questions, but also then says, what kind of a man created a group of men who during the Civil War carried out the worst atrocities of that conflict,
from Ballyseedy and all the rest of it.
And those people, and not just that, but the murder gang in Dublin and so on, they are all carried out by the squad. They are carried out by Collins' key people who are intensely loyal to him. So either he created this group of men and bore no responsibility for the kind of things they were going to do, or during the Civil War, if the anti-treatyites turned to guerrilla war, which they were doing in August, when they ceased to fight a regular battle and the war started to get more difficult, then Collins would have said, well, we may have to use different tactics to crush them. And I think he would have ultimately. It wasn't an easy decision for Kevin O'Higgins. Kevin O'Higgins said at Cabinet, do we have to do this? This man was the best man at my wedding, Rory O'Connor. And the rest of the Cabinet said, yeah, we do have to do it. So ultimately, this was a brutal war where horrible things were done. But I don't think you can say, oh, if Michael had lived, it would have been all different. They'd have all shaken hands and got on the road to Belfast. That was not going to happen.
I was just going to agree with Brian, because Kerry is the site of the worst atrocities of the Civil War. And they are all enacted by aspects or parts of Collins's
squad. But they're all doing it because they think they're avenging Michael Collins' death. I mean, I think that's what it is. I mean, I certainly don't see Collins as being the type of guy who would shoot his childhood friend. He would not kill his best man. These are weaker people who see there's only one way out for them now.
These are the guys who were the cutting edge of the IRA in Dublin, who, if we believe what we do about the IRA in Dublin, had taken the war to the Brits. Why within 6 months do they do these things? What does that say about militarism, about Collins, about the kind of group he created? And actually, the anti-treatyites don't generally do this. And the civilians in the Free State government don't either. You know, so this is a big question.
Sorry,
if a brave member of the audience wants to ask a question. Yes.
I'm going to be the person everyone hates, more than of a comment than a question. But I suppose going back to would he shoot his childhood best friend, I think as a person with certain sympathies towards Michael Collins, I think we can't rule that out whatsoever. It was a war. We see it, like you mentioned, best men, others' weddings, best friends being torn apart by treaty. Even you saw it in the 70s with the IRA, with the provost list. You know, so I don't think you can whatsoever rule that out for any single person in that war for not to kill someone that they loved at one point.
The only thing you ever need to know is before Michael Collins dies, there's no executions. After he dies, there is. That's all you need
but
to know.
The war had changed completely, and the executions don't happen until November, by which time the anti-treaty IRA had put the Free State on the back foot. I mean, they had actually begun from their point of view, carry out successful operations.
I know, but
so the war had changed.
I know, but I do a mafioso thing in the show. I didn't have time to do it today. It's basically cleaning house. They kill Erskine Childers, who knows everything about the treaty. They have to kill four guys before him because he can't kill a made guy first. Then they kill Liam Mellows, Rory O'Connor, Dick Barrett, all of those guys, Joe McKelvey, all involved in the transport of arms to the north. They kill Sean Hales, the only guy who wants to... Sorry, Sean Hales is assassinated by the IRA in Dublin.
He is shot by the IRA in Dublin.
The witness is a British soldier. That's the only witness. The Hales family themselves
were disgraced. No, the IRA admitted doing that as well, and they said they were going to shoot every TD who voted for the murder bill.
I know, but it's amazing how they first shoot.
We can read an enormous amount of the things that people at the time were quite clear about. Liam Lynch and everybody else at the time is quite clear. We will shoot every government TD who supports the executions.
Yeah.
The first one we shot was Hales. We should have got more. We should have shot O'Malley. There is no conspiracy about that. It was a brutal war. And the fact is that we can attribute... You know, I ultimately think the British are responsible through the threat of immediate and terrible war for forcing both sides of the Republican movement into this war.
But why is Sean Hales sent?
But once the war was on, they went at it with gusto. And it said something about Collins' men on the pro-treaty side that they began to enjoy it. And it also says about the way they viewed their enemies. Collins already, to Mulcahy in July, is talking about the anti-treatyites being brigands, cutthroats, ruffians. He lost his nostalgia by the time he went to Cork.
Okay, listen, guys, I want to just pivot this what-if discussion in a slightly different direction. And I'm going to throw this one to David McCullough, right? So what if Michael Collins and not Eamon de Valera had become Ireland's dominant statesman? What would have happened, David?
I think if de Valera had been shot in West Cork in 1922, we'd be sitting here saying, what if only de Valera had survived, what a great country we'd live in now. I think we project onto Michael Collins all sorts of nonsense, both his detractors and his supporters, wildly overestimate the influence one man could have had on politics. If he had survived, if he had been the dominant figure, how much would have been different? Would the government have been less deferential to the Catholic Church? Absolutely no evidence to suggest that would be the case. Collins was a regular mass goer during the treaty negotiations. He was perhaps not as pious as de Valera was, but he was a politician. He would have known which side things were buttered. Would women have been treated better in an independent Ireland dominated by Collins than dominated by de Valera? Well, it could hardly be much worse, in fairness. De Valera had quite the problem with women, but there's no evidence to suggest that Collins would have been any more forthcoming than Kevin O'Higgins, who banned women from sitting on juries in 1926. Would he have been more open to economic development? Would he have been some people think he was some kind of a socialist. He was very much in the Treasury mould. The reason that the Irish Civil Service is dominated, and was dominated by the Department of Finance, was because of the First Minister for Finance, one Michael Collins.
Just repeat that, guys, just because some people might be up to speed on this. Michael Collins' main role in the War of Independence was as Minister for Finance, with a briefcase and a suit. And that is a more accurate image of Michael Collins than the one that those fantastic photographs in full uniform.
We do actually have writings from Collins, which normally never get quoted because they're actually really banal in terms of the kind of ideas that they're expressing. So I'll give you two really brief quotes. One is when he's talking about the need to sort of resist and reverse Anglicisation, and really that's what the independence struggle is about. And he says, "The extent to which we become free and secure our freedom will be the extent to which we become Gaels again. We can fill our minds with Gaelic ideas and our lives with Gaelic customs until there is no room for any other." You know, that if de Valera said that, you couldn't really put a cigarette paper between the two. Yeah. And here's Collins on social and economic policy. Our object in building up the country economically is not to be able to boast of enormous wealth or a great volume of trade for their own sake. It's not to see our country covered with smoking chimneys and factories. The real riches of the Irish nation will be the men and women of the Irish nation, the extent to which they are rich in body and mind and character. So, in other words, this is very much what David's saying, in terms of social and economic policy, in terms of a kind of Catholic moral framework, in terms of the idea of Gaelic revivalism, these guys were pretty much on the same page. You're looking at potentially quite small differences, maybe more tariffs to build up industry. Griffith probably would have supported that too, and Fianna Fáil did in the 1930s. Maybe a slightly more kind of Republican rhetoric. I think certainly they could have pushed more in terms of building on the treaty. Cumann na Gael get locked into a sense that they're sort of defending the treaty settlement that they fought for in the Civil War. I think with Collins, you would have had a more ambitious kind of, ripping up of dismantling of elements of the treaty that you see De Valera do in the 1930s. But basically, you know, it's pretty similar kind of ideological outlook that we're talking about this revolutionary kind of generation of Republicans, I think.
Paddy, you want to come back on that one?
For me, Collins is a bit more, I mean, I've read those quotes as well, but he also does very good stuff about culture and paths to freedom path to freedom. And, he's kind of, his experience in London for 10 years, working for JP Morgan, working for various different people, he's got a bit more of an outward look. You know what I mean? I don't know if he'd be into the EU, for instance, because once they start an EU army, he'd like the grocery shop idea, but he wouldn't like an EU army. I think he's a little bit more out. He's not a Catholic. I know what you're saying, David, that he was a Catholic and went mass going, but he was kind of doing that for Kitty Kiernan. Before that, he didn't. In 1911, Collins writes a piece where he says that the hierarchy of the church should be exterminated. I mean, everyone forgets how extreme Collins was as a Republican. He really was. And I'm not saying this as a blue shirt. I'm a complete anti-treaty Republican. I'm trying to reclaim Collins for Sinn Féin, actually. And I just think that this idea that he was going to be a daily communicant. I mean, the only time Collins went into mass was to plan assassinations, because it was the easiest place to do it. There might be an element of Catholicism, but I don't think he was going to really go for it the way Dev did. I really don't think he was going to be the uber Catholic person. I don't know if Ireland would have been that different. But remember when Dev came in 1932, didn't he say about the Cumann na Gael government? He said, geez, they're doing a great job, and just leave the church running everything. Do you know what I mean? So I don't know if Collins would have been.
No, he was talking about the developments in the Commonwealth, I think.
Yeah, okay. But what I'm thinking is that Collins might have been a bit less Catholic, but then would have been just easy. You know, the way Dev and the rest of them said, these guys can run the schools, this could be fine. You know?
Okay, guys, if you just
it's walked
into the
if.
Tent...
I'm sorry, it's all what if here.
You just walked into a big argument here. We're looking at what if Michael Collins had survived the Civil War. Now, I want to just go back, David, one thing you said, that if Eamon de Valera and not Michael Collins got shot in West Cork, you know, we'd be having the same discussion. There's one big difference, right? That was Michael Collins was far, far better looking than Eamon de Valera. And I'm not saying that as a joke. I'm talking here about his image, right? Because it seems to me that 99% of the attitudes people have about Michael Collins are actually determined by his image.
That's open to discussion, actually. The Provost of Trinity, Mahaffey, at the time, his daughter was observing prisoners going past the front of Trinity, and she commented on the singularly good-looking tall man who was, in fact, De Valera. So, you know, some women went for
Eat
De Valera.
Your hat, Michael Collins.
And in fairness,
and maybe
Collins
De Valera didn't spend as much time posing in military uniform.
And Collins was piling on the pounds towards the end as well, so who knows what he would have looked
like. No, it's a serious point, guys, because, you know, if Collins had survived, right, and as you say, David, like, imagine if, you know, I'm talking about young Elvis, old Elvis here, right? Imagine if he put on weight and imagine if he looked as bad as Owen Duffy did, you know, 10 years later, for example.
He might have done if he'd been drinking as much. But, dying young is very good for your career. Yeah. You have to remember that. You know, Lennon versus McCartney. Lennon would never have released the Frog Chorus, whereas De Valera had plenty of Frog Choruses in his later years. Because if you have a lifetime's career in politics, you are going to make compromises, you are going to make mistakes, and you're going to be held responsible for them.
This society does love to project everything negative onto something called De Valera's Ireland. We imagine we were all innocent, pure people, and two people, you know, Eamon De Valera and possibly McQuaid, corrupted our innocence.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think obviously individuals and their images do matter,
But, you know, the Irish Revolution succeeded not because Collins was brilliant at planning assassinations at mass, which isn't just the reason he went to mass, by the way. He went because the vast majority of that generation were devout Catholics, but because of a popular mass movement. And we forget again and again, hundreds of thousands of ordinary Irish men and women that lent to the breadth of the country were the reason why British rule was broken, at least in the 26 counties. Not because of the magical elements of Michael Collins, not because of the squad in Dublin, who are overrated anyway, I think, in military terms, not because even of the IRA's armed struggle. There was over 100,000 men in the IRA. There was only weapons for 5,000. Most IRA volunteers never killed anyone. But hundreds of thousands of people took part in general strikes, boycotts, withdrew their obedience from British rule in hundreds of ways every day. And that was the reason the revolution succeeded to the point that it did. Now, De Valera is a much bigger international figure until the truce period. Collins becomes a bigger figure in London during that period. So there's a difference in how they're viewed. There's still mythology that the British, for example, only found out what Collins looked like during the negotiations. He's on the cover of the RIC Wanted Hue and Cry in December 1920 because there's a picture of him from the first Dáil because he was Minister for Finance. He's on the cover of the Gaelic American in New York. The British had people in New York too. So, but Collins becomes a bigger personality and his myth grows. But so does the myths about thousands of people around the country. So I think we've got to think beyond the big personalities to see this as much part of a wider struggle and revolution. They are important. But I think ultimately, I mean, unfortunately, when you look at what they believed in one great thing, which was breaking the power of Britain over Ireland. But in terms of what they believed about overturning society, very often they were very conventional, certainly very pious. Sean T. O'Kelly goes to the Vatican in 1921 and he says, they're trying to get an audience with the Pope, and he says, you know, the difference between us and these other revolutionary movements in Europe is that we have never sought to deny your authority. So he's saying to the Vatican, on behalf of Sinn Féin, we're not anti-clerical. And I think Collins shared that with De Valera. And I think there were exceptions. You know, Lamass in 1925 is talking about if we'd broken the power of the church, it would have been a good thing. But by the time Lamass gets into the cabinet, that's fine. The church is a great stabilizing influence, and the Republicans knew that. So I think we're projecting 21st century Ireland onto a lot of these people. Not all of them, there are exceptions. But I think we've got to look beyond the great men to look at the women, the ordinary men and women as well.
Yeah, just a quick point on Tommy's point about the sort of image of Collins, which I think is important. These people's public reputations didn't stay kind of consistent after their death. You know, De Valera used to be a lot more popular. And someone like Patrick Pearse, for example, and right up to the 50s, 60s, Patrick Pearse was someone who was a revolutionary hero. People don't really see Pearse in that light anymore. He's seen as a little, the Catholicism, the zealotry, is seen as a little bit creepy or odd, you know?
I love him.
Whereas if you look at Collins, his image, the cursing, the fighting, even the kind of the lover, it's a more kind of modern image. It may be just image, but that's important. And the other thing I would say about changing reputations is Collins really goes stellar quite late, the 1990s. Two important contexts. The Michael Collins movie, but also that movie reflects the peace process. Suddenly Collins, the man who makes the treaty, becomes very, very relevant because it's seen as a model for what's happening in Northern Ireland in the 1990s. So there's like all sorts of factors after their lives shape their public reputations as they rise and fall. And Collins, because he died the first, we can read the most into and invent, I suppose, project what we like into his values.
Now, just before I go, the next, my final counterfactual. Anyone from the audience want to come in, guys? We'll be wrapping up in about 10 or 15 minutes, because this is it's going hammering tongs up here. So if anyone wants to come in, just put your hand up and we'll give you the mic. Now, listen. The final question I want to throw out here is: what if Michael Collins and not Owen O'Duffy had become the leader of the Blue Shirts, Fergal?
Well, I think the Blue Shirts would have been led a lot more successfully, that's for sure. They would have been led by a sort of...
But that's the scary thing. That's what I'm getting at.
Yeah. Well, I actually answer this question a slightly different way, if I may, which is the Blue Shirts use Collins really effectively. So Collins is very valuable as a sort of political resource when he's dead. And I'll just give you a couple of examples of this. The Blue Shirts claim to represent the spirit of Michael Collins. Blue Shirt propaganda again and again describes O'Duffy as the heir to Collins. So the Blue Shirt newspaper, for example, describes O'Duffy
as a gay, debonair edition of the old Michael Collins. I think the only bit of that that's true is the gay bit, you know, not so much the debonair. But in fairness, Michael Collins really rated Donal Duffy. He called him the best man in Ulster, and he called him the coming man. And he reportedly claimed, "If I fall, you have O'Duffy." And I just wanted to give you a couple of examples of how the Blue Shirts used Collins's legacy in, you know, quite interesting ways. O'Duffy presents the Blue Shirts as fulfilling Michael Collins's mission. If we die, it will be as guardians of the cause for which Collins was a martyr. And the March on Dublin, which is the event which sees the banning of the Blue Shirts, so it's kind of potentially emulating Mussolini's March on Rome, that was actually to Michael Collins's cenotaph. And then, as Paddy mentioned in the show, Bail na Blow actually becomes a sort of a site for fascist rallies in 1933 and 1934 with Blue Shirts doing the raised arms.
So there seems to be a direct parallel to the situation in Spain, where is it Jose Prima de Vera, you know, is killed and becomes a kind of a fascist martyr, and then, you know, and becomes the martyr of the Falange Party. So is there a direct parallel there?
Yeah, I think there's. If we put sort of Irish politics into European patterns, what you see is most of the new states that emerge after the First World War are democracies in the 1920s. And in the early to mid-1930s, most of those democracies collapse. So Ireland is probably, you could argue, even the only new state that emerges after the First World War that sustains its democracy. So in other words, the pattern which produces Ona Duffy, someone coming from the police or the army, who basically doesn't want to hand over political power to a Republican or a left opposition, that's pretty much the pattern of politics across Europe, apart from a handful of old established states in Western Europe. So I don't know about Collins, but we can certainly, what does happen with Ona Duffy is part and parcel of what's happening across Europe.
It's all amazingly interesting for me because, but having read everything about Collins, I don't think he was someone who was subject to international fads or trends. I don't, maybe economically, but certainly I don't think he would have enjoyed fascism or seen it as a thing to emulate. I really don't see Collins in that regard. He was very much an Ireland, Irish, you know, we'll run our own stuff. We're not going to be like these other people around the world. That's just this is a what if, and I can be countered on it no matter what. But I just think that there's nothing fascistic in Collins. I know he's very much a dictator, but I don't think he'd go down the road of blue shirts and all the rest of it and emulating the brown shirts or the black shirts. He certainly wouldn't send people to Spain, you know, to 800 people to Spain, which Fine Gael always say, oh, sure, they were only sweeping out the trenches. Yeah, yeah, but you took part in the massacre of 500,000 people. You were part of the support network for that, the Blue Shirt. So let's just stop this whole idea that the IRA and the IRA alone in the 30s and 40s were the only people who aligned themselves with fascism. I think it's hard to see Collins actually doing that. It's hard to see him doing it. But that, again, it's just how I base my... Because, again, I'm as bamboozled as you are. He's unbelievably good-looking. He's very charismatic. You know, I do a whole show about him. You say he's okay, Margaret, but, you know, there's a lot of girls here who would disagree. But you're very choosy. I get that. But what I'm saying is it's just, you know, it's hard with Collins because, again, like David said, he dies at 31. He's a rock star. He's just a rock star. De Valera is 95 when he dies. He's not a rock star.
I think it suits everyone in Ireland, though, to underestimate the strength of the Blue Shirts as a movement in the 1930s. And they were a very important movement for what became Cumann na Gael or Fine Gael. But a young scholar called Max Nastri is just about to publish a book on the Blue Shirts. But I suppose his argument would be that they're much stronger than we think. And also the Paul Bew line, which is that, you know, they do represent the disaffection of the big farmer grazier class, who are completely alienated by, I suppose, Dev's campaigns on various levels. But the point about the Blue Shirts is that I think Collins would have made them more successful and fitted in very nicely, because they're kind of a radical movement within, if you like, the right. But it's like De Valera has already stolen those clothes
but in Collins
the 1932
isn't
election. Well, no, de Valera has kind of pulled the radicalism and the Catholicism together into the popular movement that becomes Fianna Fáil. So you can see the blue shirts as an attempt to do something like that, that kind of fails because that ground of politics has already been removed from them, or they can't get a wide enough class basis.
The blue shirts represent treaty-eyed republicanism. So we associate the pro-treaty coming out of the 1920s. Oh, these people weren't republicans, they weren't interested in Northern Ireland, they weren't interested in separatism. Of course, you know, many of them were, and I think the blue shirts is the last gasp of a sort of almost like, and this is where there is a connection with Collins, it's a kind of a militarist republicanism. Many people who supported the treaty didn't suddenly give up the revolutionary values that they'd been struggling for and willing to forward using military means. So I think that's what O'Duffy and the blue shirts do stand for, as well as the economic, but they stand for a genuine
strong farmers on big black horses as well, though.
But so my show is also right.
Militarism.
Brian, you want to come in?
Yeah, obviously, I mean, you can't say because Collins is dead. But if you look at the number of people who were close to him, including O'Duffy, in 1922, O'Duffy is well-liked in Belfast as by the IRA there, as a guy who has their interests at heart. He's given them the lead, O'Duffy, who's going to take a strong line against partition. He's regarded as a Republican hero. If he'd been killed then, we talk about him completely differently. So the fact is that lots of Collins' close allies, both from at leadership level and at rank and file level, end up in the blue shirts. And it's a big selling point for them that they are Collins' close allies. I mean, you should look into the career of Captain Conroy, who's part of the convoy at Baile na Blau for some of the grim places these people could go. Now, there's no evidence that Michael Collins in 1922 is thinking very deeply about fascism, but he is influenced by international trends. All Irish Republicans are. They're deeply influenced by what's going on in the world. And he is saying by the summer of 1922 that Bolshevism and anarchy and disorder is dangerous and that Labour will have to be dealt with. And that's really, in many ways, the seeds of a more authoritarian right-wing politics. But the key thing about the blue shirts as well, which is what people forget. See, today people like John Bruton get called a blue shirt. John Bruton's not a blue shirt. He never could have been one because he's a home ruler. Yeah. The blue shirts were not home rulers. The blue shirts were nationalists. O'Duffy talks about, you know, it'll be time soon to invade the North.
The United Ireland Party.
Yes, and the point is that fits in some ways to Collins. But we can't say because the man was dead, so we don't know. But a lot of the people around him did go that direction.
Just to get back to your original question, what would have happened if Collins had led the blue shirts instead of O'Duffy? Well, maybe that would have destroyed Collins' reputation the way it destroyed O'Duffy's, because as Fergal says, and by the way, folks, if you only ever buy one history book about Irish history, buy Fergal's book about Owen O'Duffy. It's superb. But we see him now as a buffoon. He wasn't a buffoon at the time. He was regarded very seriously. He was a brilliant organiser. He'd done a brilliant job in the IRA, done a brilliant job in the GAA. I think it's the ladies' football still contest for the O'Duffy Cup, isn't it?
Yeah.
Not a lot of people know that. Yes. And he'd done a brilliant job in the Guards up to the point where he started going mad. So he was a serious figure. He was a well-respected figure, and leading the blue shirts destroyed him.
I suppose I have it written down here, the thing that always strikes me about Collins, the saying, you have to have five things. Sorry, is that better?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You always have to have five things to make you a hero, which is young, handsome, intelligent, charismatic, and dead. And I think with him, he ticked all the boxes there.
Yeah. Now, anyone else would like to come in from the floor? Because this is your last chance, guys. This is a final warning. I tell you, I think we're going to have to wrap up here. We will have to wrap up here. We're not going to run over like the previous performer.
Sorry.
No, I just want to make a final comment here. I mean, just to say, I think Brian has said this already. Nothing in this discussion is to undermine or criticise the role Michael Collins did play in achieving the sovereignty which we all enjoy. Now, enjoy is a relative term, of course. And de Valera and all those people in difficult circumstances. And Margaret has already referred to the contingencies. You know, the situation that forces people to make decisions that they don't determine. It's not all a conspiracy. But I think one thing comes out of this discussion is we were remarkably lucky in this country because, you know, that we kept on the democratic road. I mean, there's various kind of side roads we could have gone off, and we've touched on a few of them here. I think also what this discussion shows is the kind of lazy revisionist idea that that the pro-treaty side was democratic and the anti-treaty side was, you know, that the pro-treaty side was democratic and the anti-treaty side undemocratic in a simplistic way. That simply does not stand up. This is a very complex situation, and the fact that we are a sovereign nation
today. You know, it's the end of a very complex story, which of course continues. So listen, I've made my little speech here. I'm going to finish up here and just let you know that this, if you haven't caught all of the proceedings here, this is a very vigorous discussion, you know. It will be on podcast on our website. There's also already up on our website a discussion on Michael Collins' Man and Myth, which discusses, you know, Collins' career. We were looking at the what if, so you might check that out. And our next podcast, we're going to be coming back to the Civil War. We're going to look at it, a military analysis, just look at it from a military point of view. And that will be posted on Friday, the 14th of October. And finally, I just had to say, I hope to see you all here next year in the sunshine. Thank you very much for tuning in to the History and Head School.